From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lots of reaction today to last night's Commander-in-Chief Forum, in which the presidential candidates were asked about national security. Today, Donald Trump tweeted, "Rough night for Hillary Clinton," after she was pressed about her vote for the war in Iraq and her private email server. Although today, an old email from Colin Powell might change the game again. It seems to support some of her claims. For her part this morning, Clinton held her first actual press conference in months outside her campaign plane, bashing Donald Trump for trash-talking American generals when he said they were reduced to rubble.
"Last night was yet another test, and Donald Trump failed yet again. We saw more evidence that he is temperamentally unfit and totally unqualified to be commander-in-chief."
Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And Rick, first, your overall impression of both candidates appearing before a military audience in New York.
I think they're both glad they have a couple weeks until the first big debate. This is the Commander-in-Chief Forum, and there were big holes, I think, in both of their performances and in their rhetoric and their explanations. I think Hillary Clinton seemed defensive. I think Donald Trump seemed to talk himself into circles at times. So I think they're both going to use the most that they can out of debate prep to try to do better with a much larger audience than you'd anticipate in a few weeks.
Well, you say Hillary Clinton seemed defensive. Here's the Republican National Committee Chair, Reince Priebus. He tweeted that Clinton sounded angry and defensive the whole time. And then here she is defending her use of the private email server while she was Secretary of State.
"What we have here is the use of an unclassified system by hundreds of people in our government to send information that was not marked. There were no headers. There was no statement, top secret, secret, or confidential. I communicated about classified material on a wholly separate system."
And Rick, take up the fact that we have the Colin Powell email released today. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee got the State Department to release Colin Powell's advice to Clinton about private emails. He'd previously said the Clinton campaign is trying to pin this on me and that she didn't ask his advice for a year after she'd been using her server. The new release shows it was actually in her first days in office she'd asked his advice. And what he'd seemed to indicate was, you know, words like try to skirt things that collect data. Your thoughts on how this is playing out?
Well, I think it backs up what Hillary Clinton has said, that she did seek advice from Colin Powell. This email seems to bear that out very directly. In terms of the substance of that advice, though, you have to wonder, and I think Republicans are posing this question, to say, why is it that she's seeking advice like that in the first place? Why not just deal with the classification systems, the law that's there? They say it shows some kind of premeditation. But I think, by and large, any day that people are talking about emails is not a winning day for Hillary Clinton. It is better than the alternative, because I do think this does back up the idea that there's some precedent for the arrangement she had, even though she went in directions that were wildly different than Colin Powell's.
And what about Donald Trump's allegations last night about what happened when he had an intelligence briefing? Let's listen.
"What I did learn is that our leadership, Barack Obama, did not follow what our experts and our truly, when they call it intelligence, it's there for a reason, what our experts said to do.
Howard.
And I was very, very surprised in almost every instance. And I could tell, I have pretty good with the body language, I could tell they were not happy."
Reclined security experts, including our own Jim Walsh, say this would have been impossible that those intelligence officers show any opinion of a sitting president.
At best, I think it's a misunderstanding of the intelligence briefings. At worst, I think it's a misconstruing or an explosive allegation, the idea that intelligence officers say, look, privately, I think we should be doing this, but he's doing that instead. I don't know that anyone really believes that to have been the case. So if that's the case, then I think maybe he misunderstood. When people are briefing him on intelligence, they're saying, this is what we know. You can infer your policy conclusions from that, but that's not their job. They don't play politics and they don't play policy. They follow the policy. So it's an extraordinary thing for any candidate to talk even in an oblique way about what happens in these intelligence briefings. But to say as directly, I could tell that what they were being told was not being followed by the president, is an explosive thing.
Well, Rick Klein, once again, people are trying to parse what Donald Trump meant, or, you know, was it the truth? And we also had his statements last night about how the U.S. should take the oil in Iraq. To the victor go the spoils. Some are calling that plunder. But a Trump surrogate, General Kellogg, was on CNN this morning saying, no, he doesn't mean that. He meant to simply protect the oil and surround it so it could be there for Iraq. Is this the pattern, the strategy, or a terrible mistake?
this does fit. I mean, her surrogates are better at explaining coherent policy than he is. That's happened time and again, and I think this is another example. I think his words were pretty clear, and you can only imagine what Hillary Clinton will say about them on that debate stage in a few weeks.
Well, but that he did mean take it.
That's right. That's the clear implication of what he said, and I think that is what he'll have to defend for himself on that debate stage. He won't have surrogates able to clean up his messes on TV.
Yeah. Well, the first debate Monday, September 26th at Hofstra University on Long Island. We will be watching. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you're listening to us in your car, did you have to pay a toll today? And if so, would you have taken a different route to avoid that toll? That question is turning into a headache for officials in Pennsylvania, where a state audit found that the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission has an unsustainable level of debt and that raising tolls will force drivers to find alternate routes. Joining us now is Eugene DePasquale, Pennsylvania's Auditor General, who conducted that audit. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy, for having me today.
And what's the core of the problem? Why aren't you bringing in enough money to pay the cost of doing business?
Basically, the Pennsylvania Turnpike was required by the legislature to give money to the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation for road and bridge projects and public transportation. The issue that really made this, you know, almost borderline financial catastrophe is that the tolling of I-80 was rejected by the federal government in 2010. When that rejection happened, there was then no additional revenue coming into the turnpike, so they then have to keep spiking the tolls up on the toll road that already exists, and it's just an unsustainable revenue moving forward.
So would you say it's more of a problem of the money that you're having to spend or the money that's coming in?
Well, it's actually both. So they were required to spend more money by the legislature than they have coming in because it was anticipated that they were going to have this tolling on 80. So it's in a sense both. They're not getting the revenue in they were projected, and thus they're still forced to spend the same money, and they just don't have the money to pay for it, so they have to keep borrowing, and the debt is simply unsustainable. And this is what our audit found, and that is the Turnpike is relying on a model of where they're going to increase tolls 53% in the next 8 years while also anticipating that they're going to get 44% greater traffic volume, which to me is just the definition of unrealistic.
Well, how much do you think tolls could go up before you start sending drivers to find alternative routes? I see that it already is going to cost more than $50 to cross the state on the turnpike.
That's correct. We think that we're starting to move into that territory already. Now, I do understand if you move tolls up at some level of a rate of inflation, that's probably manageable for most motorists. But when you're talking about getting, certainly above inflation, which has been the last couple of years, but moving into the 50% category, clearly, you know, look, truck drivers, they have computer models now to figure out what's the cheapest route and the quickest route to get there. They're just going to start using Interstate 80 across the state and other back roads to avoid the tolls because the cost will be prohibitive, and other drivers will start doing the same thing. And we've already seen in the last 3 to 4 years, it started really in 2011, that the increase in vehicle traffic that had been happening since the beginning of the turnpike had started to level off. So I think that's partly at least attributed to the toll increases over the last 3 years to begin with.
There was a surprising number in this report, which was that you're losing tens of millions of dollars from people who don't pay the tolls. They just go through. Now, I go through a toll every single day, and I thought if you didn't pay the toll, they'd come after you. So what's going on there?
They take a picture of your license plate, and they send you a bill. But Pennsylvania is one of only a couple states in the country that has no other mechanism to force payment. So, you know, when you go get your, you know, vehicle renewed or you get your driver's license renewed, they don't make you pay that bill for the uncollected tolls as well. And so there's now legislation pending in Harrisburg that hopefully will get action in the fall to change that, because you're talking tens of million dollars a year where people just blow through the toll and then they don't even pay it.
Do you expect Pennsylvania will follow the lead of states like Florida and Illinois and just get rid of toll booths altogether and have these automatic systems that just take a picture of your license plate as you drive through?
I think that day is eventually coming. I would say it's at least 5 years away, though, from the climate politically speaking and how the negotiations go with the Turnpike Commission and depend on some other issues. But I do think that day is inevitable.
And when you look at the overall picture in Pennsylvania and the money going out and the money coming in, have you talked to your colleagues in other states? And is it a situation that is unique to Pennsylvania because you have to spend some of the money that you get on public transit and bridges and roads and all of that? Or is this something that is a problem across the country?
Funding public transit is an issue all across the country, but how we're doing it makes it unique that the Turnpike and the Toll Road Commission has this overloaded burden of debt. So we did look at our surrounding states in the toll road, and the other states were not nearly as bad as we were.
And I imagine there are some people listening to this saying, well, you should be paying for public transit because it'll cut down on the traffic on your roads and it's good for the overall population.
As a former three-term legislator before I became the state auditor general, I am a huge proponent of public transportation. It's just that you have to have revenue to pay for it, and this is not a sustainable way to pay for it.
That's Eugene DePasquale, who is Pennsylvania's auditor general. Eugene, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, Jeremy. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And whether you're standing, sitting, driving, or taking public transit, you're listening to Here and Now. And Sunday marks 15 years since 9/11. And all this week, we're having conversations with a range of people about the legacy of the attacks. Right now, we're going to hear from three teenagers who were born in 2001. Gabe Ferris in Waterville, Maine, Kira O'Connor in Columbus, Ohio, and Eric Weibel in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I want to go around and just ask everyone first. You were obviously too young to remember 9/11, but do you remember when you first became aware of it? Gabe, let's start with you.
Yes, I do remember when I first became aware about 9/11. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and it was when I was interested in the aviation career. I had done some research on my own and found out about the attacks.
What do you mean research on your own? You just went online?
Yes, I was online just trying to learn whatever I could about aviation and becoming a commercial pilot, and I stumbled upon some terrorism attacks and delved more into the information.
Did you watch those videos?
I have not seen any videos of the actual attack. It's just something I prefer not to watch.
And did you, after you found out about it, did you go ask your parents or your teachers or somebody?
Yeah, I spoke to my parents afterwards and we discussed it, and they had explained what they were doing and what I was doing when the attacks occurred.
And what about you, Kira? How did you find out about it?
I was living in New York at the time of the attacks. So from a fairly younger age, I would hear about it, and my father has a picture of the Twin Towers before they were hit that I saw from a fairly young age. But I think the time that I learned the most about it and it kind of sunk in was in about fifth grade. We watched a video, and it had a lot of first-person accounts and video of the aftermath and some of the actual attack. And I learned about it a little bit from my parents, but it is a fairly sensitive topic. We don't always talk about it. And I have younger siblings, so while I might have been old enough to hear it and learn about it, they were not.
And what did you think when you found out about it?
When I first found out about it and when I first started realizing it, I feel like I was more realizing, oh, I know where that is, in a video when they would talk about different parts of New York City.
And what about you, Eric Weibel, in Scranton? When did you first find out about the 9/11 attacks?
I remember when I was in first grade, I read a book. I think it was The Man Who Walked Between the Towers. It was of a tightrope artist who was able to string a tightrope along the North and South Towers and walked across it. And I remember the book ending with how the towers weren't there any longer. It didn't explain why. I was only in first grade, but I believe that was my first introduction to that it was changed. But I do remember in fourth and fifth grade, that was when it started being taught in school, and I talked with my family, my parents about it and where they were on the day. But honestly, it was that picture book that introduced me to the topic.
And have you ever watched the videos?
I have. I believe we saw them in eighth grade at my school. They were extremely upsetting because you could here you could see, you could almost feel all the terror that the people in New York City were feeling at the time. What really struck me most was there's this one video where it was showing the North Tower. It had just been hit. So all the newscasts, all the billboards in New York City were showing this, and you could see the plane just come in and strike the South Tower. And around that time, people had just stopped in the streets. They were shrieking, and the camera turned, and you could just, traffic was at a dead stop, and it wasn't because of people trying to get where they needed to go.
Yeah.
It was because everyone was listening to the radio, watching TV.
Well, let me ask you this, starting with you, Gabe. People back then when that happened, and I'm old enough to have lived through that event, they said the world changed on 9/11, that everything was different, that there was a lack of a sense of security in the U.S. as a result of what had happened. What do you think about that? I mean, you've grown up all along since the world changed, but do you recognize 9/11 as a moment when the world changed?
Yes, I think that's very true. I do recognize 9/11 as a moment when the world changed. As you said, security has changed in America, and that change in security is all I'll ever know. And I think we're more open to talking about terrorism and attacks at the dinner table with our families and in school, because it's an important part about growing up in the U.S. nowadays.
Kira, what about you? All three of you have grown up your whole life while the U.S. is at war.
I think the 9/11 attacks were the wake-up call, so to speak, and it was the time when the U.S. realized that, yes, we are a united people and we have been attacked. And it doesn't matter that it was just in D.C. or New York or Pennsylvania. It was an attack on all of us. And it kind of showed the world that the U.S. banded together. And I mean, all over the country, they were sending things to New York and D.C. and Pennsylvania to firefighters and to victims, and we all united. And after that, yes, the world, I do think, has become a little bit of a more scary place. A lot sometimes when you think about the terrorist attacks in recent times, San Bernardino and Sandy Hook. But I think the change, it was calamitous. I mean, it was huge, the change that happened because of 9/11. And security is higher. And like Gabe said, I mean, that's all we'll ever know. So I guess the change is different for us because, as you said, you lived through it. So the change for you would be looking back on what it was to what it is now. But for us, I feel like the change is more from then to now. We can even see the change in security even after it. And 15 years after it, the security is still getting tighter and the world is still at war.
Yeah, I will tell you one thing. It's a small thing, but it is a big change from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. You used to, when you went to the airport, if your parents were dropping you off, they could walk you right to the gate through security. Obviously, you can't do that anymore. Eric Weibel, what about you? What do you think about security post-9/11 and how the world has changed?
Well, yes, we will never fully understand how it has changed, but I believe that while we have banded together, we've also become a little bit less trusting of outsiders. To me, that's the biggest change, and security reflects that. And now, with more terroristic attacks, security is still changing. And honestly, I think trust is one of the biggest changes that has happened.
Well, let me ask you finally to each of you how you think the legacy of 9/11 will affect your future, starting with you, Eric.
I believe that our generation will not fully know how America and the world was beforehand. We do know how bad it can be, and from there we can build forward instead of realizing how good it was, how much it fell. and then trying to build back up.
What about you, Kara?
It's a tough question because the legacy of 9/11 means so many different things to different people. I mean, just looking back on it, my parents tell me when we do discuss it that the hardest part for them was everyone around them knew someone that didn't make it. That 9/11 forever changed their history and their future. And that's part of the legacy. Part of the legacy is that we did band together, like Eric said, but now we have so much distrust with one another because of that. But I think the ultimate legacy of 9/11 on our generation would be that the world is a different place and not everyone is going to get along, but we need to get past that because as much as we distrust each other, we're the only way we're going to survive. We have to be together and we have to help one another because we're all connected. And I feel like 9/11 showed that even more because the whole world stopped, and especially the U.S. stopped and paid attention on those days, on those weeks afterwards and months afterwards. And I feel like that's the legacy that we need to keep in mind, is that we're all connected. And if someone hurts one of us, it hurts all of us.
Gabe Ferris, back to you. What do you think the legacy of 9/11 means for your future?
I think Kira said it best. It's that the post-9/11 world is very, very different than the pre-9/11 world. And with all the attacks going on around us, I think, like Eric said, we do need to band together and become one and try to understand this as one group.
That's Gabe Ferris in Waterville, Maine, Kira O'Connor in Columbus, Ohio, and Eric Weibel in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Three people who were born in 2001 as we remember 9/11, 15 years on. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you,
Thank
Jeremy.
You. Thank you.
A family sending kids back to school know all about the supplies list, so maybe they reuse a backpack or a binder. In Eugene, Oregon, school districts are cutting costs by reusing schools, actually material from newly demolished schools. Brian Bull of KLCC has our story.
A dump truck rolls through a gate, headed towards a pile of rubble. Where the old Roosevelt Middle School in Eugene used to stand, excavators and bulldozers scoop out dirt and old brush in the shadow of the new Roosevelt School just a few hundred feet away. Eugene has long been an environmentally conscious community. Carrie Delph is a spokeswoman for Eugene School District 4J. She says their first priority is to find materials that can be salvaged and sent to some of the other 30 schools in the district.
So at Roosevelt, for example, as I walked through the hallways on its final days, I saw staff taking doorknobs off of the doors. We have stacks of chairs in good condition, removed desks and tables and other materials that could be reused.
Delph is standing on the site of another school demolition, Howard Elementary. She says salvage materials are also auctioned off or offered to private and charter schools and nonprofits.
Not everything can be salvaged, but the district works to find a home quickly for materials that we can. Bring Recycling gathers a lot of materials for reuse in our community, so we expect that some of these materials that used to live in the school will now wind up in residents' homes.
At Bring Recycling Center, Executive Director Carolyn Stein opens a large storage building to reveal some of their salvage materials from the school district.
These are wood shop workbenches that came out of Roosevelt Middle School. They're pretty fantastic. They have this 2-inch thick wood top with the vise and metal lockers at the bottom to hold tools. And I think you could probably even get some carved initials of some kid from 1980 on here.
Stein says reusing materials, fixtures, and appliances is a better practice than recycling. She says, for example, it takes time and energy to melt down a steel sink and recast it versus rescuing one from the wrecking ball and handing it off to a new home.
You have these materials that are already made. To recycle them would reduce their value in some way, whereas if you reuse them in their current form, you save all that energy.
That largely jibes with what the EPA and other environmental agencies are saying. And reuse and recycling can reduce landfill costs by 35%. Salvage materials just helped another community group rebound from a rough experience.
It was the exact same week that we caught the place on fire, so it just was God's timing.
Marshall Eck is the food services director for the Eugene Mission for the Homeless. A fire gutted his kitchen last June, causing $300,000 in damage. This all happened during Roosevelt Middle School's demolition. Eck shows off some high-end commercial-grade coolers, which are donated by the school district, along with some grills and a hot dog roller.
It's new in my world, that's for sure. Typically, you think a school district and you think there's all these hoops, jumps, and everything you'd have to do to even get that equipment, you would assume that it would just be probably discarded in a scrapyard.
X says what the Eugene Mission won't use, like that hot dog roller, can be sold, with funds going towards its organization. Reuse advocates hope contractors and building operators alike take the time to assess what's salvageable before knocking down a structure. They say it saves money, benefits those who may not be able to afford their own materials or appliances, and lessens landfill waste. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene.
A $25,000 donation from Donald Trump's charitable foundation has been in the news this week. The donation was made to Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi's fundraising committee in 2013, days after a news report that her office was considering investigating Trump University for fraud. She did not go through with the investigation and has since endorsed Donald Trump for president. Trump has denied wrongdoing, but there are questions about whether that donation was legal. Business journalist Ali Velshi joins us now from New York. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Donald Trump actually paid a $2,500 penalty to the IRS last week over this contribution. What do we know about the legality?
Well, it's very, very clear. Under the Federal Election Campaign Act, charitable organizations are prohibited from making contributions having to do with elections. So that would have been illegal. The question, of course, is whether or not Donald Trump's campaign or his charity knew that's what they were doing. They claim that they made the donation to a group called Justice for All, which is a Kansas-based nonprofit. The group that got the money was something called And Justice for All. Just one word difference, but it happened to be the PAC that was backing Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi.
And you just, in a situation like this, is this typical that you just pay a fine and that's the end of it, or if you break the law?
Oh, more often than not, that's correct. The IRS doesn't have the resources to try and prosecute. They only do that in instances where they are really trying to go after somebody who they know is habitually committing crimes. Generally speaking, you pay a fine. The issue here is Trump's charity paid the fine, but they still say that this had nothing to do with donating to the campaign of the Attorney General.
But then there was also a fundraiser that Trump held for Pam Bondi's election at Mar-a-Lago. That's his resort in Palm Beach, after she decided not to join the lawsuit against Trump University. Does that sort of thing raise any eyebrows from election officials?
Well, here's the thing. The holding of a fundraiser, by a private citizen, Donald Trump, is not a problem. The problem is whether or not there's quid pro quo behind it, right? Pam Bondi says, we didn't have anything to do with this decision not to prosecute Trump University, not to sue them. That decision, she claims, didn't even get to her. It was made by junior people in the office. Trump says his charitable organization accidentally gave her the contribution. So the whole thing is muddy. It is not necessarily illegal until someone can prove that there was intent to hold this fundraiser in exchange for further favorable treatment.
Well, Donald Trump was asked about the donation that we were talking about earlier on Monday when he took questions from reporters on his plane. He said he never spoke to Pam Bondi about it. Here he is.
I never spoke to her. First of all, she's beyond reproach. She's a fine person. Never spoke to her about it at all.
What is Pam Bondi saying about what happened?
She says the same thing. She said she's denied any connection between his donation and her office's decision not to proceed. She said it's not true what the Clinton campaign is saying, that she knew about the investigation. She has said their two are just not connected. She is, however, a Donald Trump supporter in the election. So it's one of those things where we know the facts. The facts don't necessarily lead us to where we want to be, but there is something that doesn't smell right about it.
Well, the New York Times reported this week that this is not the only time that Trump has run afoul of campaign finance rules. What are some of the other examples?
Well, in the 1980s, he testified under oath in New York State after he had directed tens of thousands of dollars through subsidiary companies for the president of the New York City Council. That way he evaded contribution limits. In the 1990s, he paid a fine of $47,000 for exceeding annual limits on campaign contributions. There are lots of things that he's done, including last year at a presidential debate, he actually said, and I'm quoting, "When you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do." So he says that he's got special inside knowledge of this, which is why when he becomes president, he's going to clean up the system because he knows how it works.
And on the other side of the campaign, on the Clinton side, there's a story this week about Bill Clinton accepting $17 million to be the honorary chancellor of the for-profit school Laureate International Universities. And then the head of Laureate got invited to a State Department dinner when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. There have been a lot of allegations of pay for play there, but what's the latest on that?
Well, this is Laureate is the biggest for-profit of these institutions, and they go and buy a lot of other for-profit institutions. This is an industry that has come under fire and scrutiny from the IRS, from the federal government, from the Consumer Protection Bureau for years. Now, the only argument here is that Bill Clinton has said that in response, you know, forgetting the money that he got, it didn't seem to change Hillary Clinton's opinion on for-profit educational institutions, and she still claims she's going to go after them. But this is another one that doesn't smell quite right.
That's business journalist Ali Velshi. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, staying with presidential politics, there's been criticism of Today Show host Matt Lauer, who moderated last night's commander-in-chief forum with the candidates. Let's take a quick check with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
And here's a moment people are talking about. It was Donald Trump talking about being against the war in Iraq and Lauer's non-follow-up.
I was against the war in Iraq because I said it's going to totally destabilize the Middle East, which it has. It has absolutely been a disastrous war. And by the way, perhaps almost as bad was the way Barack Obama got out. That was a disaster.
People talk about you and Commander-in-Chief and not just Secretary Clinton, but some of your Republican opponents in the primary season, and they wonder about your temperament.
So, David Folkenflik, a lot of people saw that as a non-sequitur, that Trump might have mentioned that, that Lauer might have mentioned that Trump told Howard Stern he was for the war in Iraq.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. Even if Lauer had been simply listening to his response and had the memory of an earthworm, he would have heard Trump say, look, you could go back to an article in 2004 in Esquire where I was against it. That would have been a year after the invasion of Iraq. That would not have been leading the charge against it prior to the invasion. Secondly, there is zero evidence in which to say it is untrue that Donald Trump came out against it. Thirdly, on the Howard Stern show, and I believe it was our friends over at BuzzFeed News who determined this first, they pulled it out from the archives, and he said – he was asked by Howard Stern, and he said kind of squishily, he's like, well, yeah, I guess I do favor going in. And this was in 2002 ahead of the invasion. So it wasn't – a full-throated roar for invasion, but it was nothing like opposition.
Yeah, well, and Matt Lauer, look, has done some sharp interviews in the past. I mean, we'll hear what he says about whether he just blanked or what happened there. But what about his treatment of Hillary Clinton? Political commentator Norman Ornstein says he continuously interrupted her and told her to hurry up.
You know, Lauer interrupted Trump a few times too, but Trump steamrolled right over him. He just sort of cast him aside. With Clinton, he spent a lot of time asking about emails, and he did it from the outset. It's not an illegitimate point to raise, but he seemed to do so in a way that assumed the seriousness and the severity of the national security breach involved. And in fact, Clinton very much disputes that, and there is some argument over what the FBI's review of that shows. But he dwelled on it at some length. It meant that when he was getting into other national security and military issues that were supposedly the point of that 30-minute back and forth he had with Clinton, he essentially kept rushing her along and saying, we don't really have time. You got to do it briefly. And these were fairly serious issues like the question of taking on ISIS. So, you know, it seemed to me as though Trump had a great deal of time to go on with seeming non sequiturs in a fairly non-responsive or vague way, and that Clinton was essentially rushed through a lot of questions of more substance.
It's a reminder maybe of how important the moderator is in these things. But while we have you, Hillary Clinton took questions today from the media outside of her plane. And the fact that she went more than 250 days without a news conference was becoming a campaign point for Donald Trump. Does this all get forgotten now if she continues to hold them?
No, I think it's baked into the narrative that she's standoffish, doesn't quite trust the press to treat her fairly. That's something that stems back essentially a generation to the 1992 Bill Clinton first campaign for the White House, and their decision to, in dealing with questions raised about their investments in Whitewater, essentially not disclose things and be transparent, a scandal that ultimately dissipated as the details came to light years later, but a lot of grief, lawsuits, and an impeachment after the fact. The campaign has started to tentatively dangle her in front of reporters more. They had defended themselves for months by saying, look how many interviews she's done. NPR, I obtained a database of all the interviews she did through the end of July from the beginning of this year. And they said, look, we've done, well over 300 interviews. Now, a decent chunk of those interviews turned out to be with folks that you wouldn't consider journalistic. One talk show host in Detroit gave her an astrological forecast. Another was done on Sirius XM radio with the mayor of North Miami Beach, who not only was a supporter but a landlord for one of her headquarter offices in Florida. But nonetheless, they are starting to give her a little bit more access to the press. She's going to need it if she's going to be elected, as she hopes, president of the United States. She needs to be able to show she can handle questions from the press.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you as always.
You bet.
It's been almost a week since Oklahoma experienced the strongest earthquake in its history, a 5.8 magnitude quake on Saturday. Scientists are pointing fingers at the state's energy industry, saying the high pressure injection of oil and gas wastewater deep underground is to blame for the thousands of quakes Oklahoma's experienced in recent years. But does a big one like Saturday's change public opinion about drilling? Joe Wirtz is a reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. He joins us from KOSU in Oklahoma City. And Joe, many days after the quake, how are residents there feeling?
Well, residents near the shaking, especially right in the area that that was struck with the earthquake, are on edge and anxious. A lot of them are still cleaning up the mess and starting to get a bigger picture of what real damage was done. Folks like Mona Denny, who live right near the epicenter of the quake, sustained quite a bit of damage.
The shaking was unreal. I've never been through anything like this ever. Everybody's okay. Everybody's okay. I've got lots of help. Phone calls been going like crazy. So it's good. It's good. God's good.
So the Denny's live in a mobile home right near the shaking, and the home actually shifted off the foundation, crumbled a couple of the pier blocks holding up their house. It also moved the whole house off the sewer line. So when I went out there the day of the earthquake, they were rushing around trying to make a makeshift repair to their sewer line so they could actually use and live inside the house. Went back there a couple days later and talked to some other folks. Gayla Schoen lives a few miles away. She wasn't actually home for the shaking, but she came back and found damage to her fireplace and to her chimney. And the talk around here is really about the cause. And some people, like Mrs. Schoen, don't quite believe what the scientists are saying.
I am not convinced that the disposal wells have anything to do with what is happening right now. There has not been any drilling going on for the last 2 years. There's not been any pumping going into the ground.
But as you say, Joe, the scientists are not with her on that. There has been drilling there, right?
There certainly has been drilling, and there has been pumping. She's right in that it hasn't been as much. And that's really a big question up until now scientists and regulators have been grappling with. The price of oil has been low. That means the activity has been a lot more diminished than it has been in the past. So, you know, what does that mean? Scientists don't know, for example, if once these earthquakes have been triggered, if there's anything they can do to stop them. And scientists are overwhelmingly convinced that these disposal wells, which the oil industry just pumps full of this waste fluid, especially here in Oklahoma, there's a lot of water that comes out of the ground with the oil and gas, and it's a briny, toxic water, and you don't want it anywhere near the surface, anywhere near the drinking water. So they pump it back in underground. And really, you know, we're up to more than a dozen peer-reviewed scientific papers now that make the link between these wells and the earthquakes. So she's at odds with what an overwhelming amount of science says.
And what about for the people of Oklahoma in general? Does this feel like a turning point where, you know, even after so many thousands of tiny earthquakes over the last few years as the energy production has really picked up, that this one was so much bigger and so much more of a problem that people will turn against the energy industry?
I don't know if it'll be as much of enough of a turning point to make people turn against the energy industry, but I do think this is the type of earthquake that scientists have predicted we could have, because we've already had one about this size. So this is sort of a realistic worst case scenario in that this is what scientists have said could be coming. I have noticed in covering this story for 3 years a shift in the average Oklahoman's perception of what the cause is and the acceptance of one of the primary economic drivers being responsible. I think people have been more accepting of the science on this. I would expect an earthquake of this magnitude to shift those even further. It's also important to note that oil and gas regulators here have been slowly at first, but now more rapidly issuing these orders to tell these companies to stop using these wells or to slow down the amount of fluid they're pumping into it. I think it will have a change not only in the people, but in the politics, in the regulatory process out here as well.
Well, do people in the industry expect a lot of new regulations now as a result of what has happened here that could really change the way they do business and reduce it?
Sure. We're seeing some pushback from the industry. They're worried. They need these disposal wells. I mean, it's key to producing oil and gas in a lot of states, and especially Oklahoma. You have to do something with this produced water. It's just part of it. So you can't produce the oil and gas without finding a way to get rid of this water. Right now, this is the government-approved, economically viable way to dispose of the waste. And, you know, there hasn't been a huge legislative push to make changes, but that's growing. It may be growing slowly, but I think we will see some response.
That's Joe Wirtz, who's a reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, joining us from Oklahoma City. Joe, thanks.
Thank you.
And if you live in Oklahoma, we'd love to hear your thoughts on drilling and whether they've changed because of the earthquake. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Online at hereandnow.org, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.